Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
At some point in the show today, Nick Chamberlain is going to play the groovy music because it's Thursday, and Thursday is Open Forum, and the groovy Open Forum music that will come on later. Open Forum means if you have a question about what we Catholics believe, what we Catholics do, why we believe those things, why we do those things, we are welcoming those questions today. 888-318-7884 is our number. If you prefer the spelling version, 888-31-TRUTH. Give us a call if you have a question, whether you are Catholic or not. Anyone is welcome to call. And taking your calls today, Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, author, among many other things, of A Daily Defense, 365 days plus one to becoming a better apologist. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, how you doing, Si?
I am well. I am very well. I'm fired up for Thursday.
Good. Me too.
Yeah, really? It's going to be high energy day today?
Well, maybe. We'll see.
We'll see. All right. Again, 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH, the number. Jimmy, a little question for you to start the day today.
Okay. I have no idea what's coming.
No, because I asked you about energy. This just came to me. Sometimes you hear this idea that our soul is energy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's my energy. Is that a proper way to talk about the soul?
Well, so not from a Catholic point of view and not from a scientific point of view. In science, energy, or one of the most common definitions of energy, is it's the capacity to do work. And while our souls
– I have no soul then.
– have energy in that they can affect things, they can do things, they're not simply the capacity to do work, at least not in any obvious way. And so it's problematic, I would say, to say the soul is energy. You do sometimes hear this thought expressed like in New Age circles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to find any scientific basis for this. In fact, there was a widespread viewpoint that was very common actually until about the last century, known as vitalism. And vitalism was the view that biological life forms, the reason that they're different than non-living things, whether corpses or stones or whatever it may be, the difference between a living thing and a non-living thing was that it had this vital life force or life energy in it. And during the course of the development of modern chemistry and biology, that view eventually was eroded away because they could not find any evidence of a vital energy in living things compared to non-living things. There are like four fundamental forces that science has been able to discover and describe in the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
That's electromagnetism, the strong force, the weak force, and gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And all four of those forces play a role, especially the first three, but all four of them play a role in life forms and in non-living things.
Yeah.
None of them are unique to living things. And so it seems that the soul, which we do have and which living things do have, is a non-empirical quality. It's one that's not subject to measurement by scientific means. And so that would make it hard to describe it as just another form of energy because it doesn't fit the other forms of energy that we have.
Right. And energy and matter and energy, unless I'm mistaken, following the theory of relativity.
Right.
They're
interchangeable.
They're states of, they're interchangeable. So I guess there's an idea that maybe well, spirit is like energy and matter is the physical stuff. But that's really not true at all. That doesn't have any...
No. In fact, as you mentioned, I mean, the famous equation E equals MC squared establishes an equivalence between matter and energy. So you can take matter and turn it into energy, and you can take energy and turn it into matter. But we're talking about physical energy here.
Yeah.
And as we've said, it seems that the soul and spiritual phenomena don't operate in that way. They're
right.
not physical by nature. They're not empirical. They're not subject to scientific measurement. And, you know, I can't rule out that someone could one day formulate a theory of how spirits work that would make sense in terms of some kind of energy. That's not something that that has been done to date. Thus problematic, since the only analog we have for energy is physical energy, and it's clearly different.
Yeah, yeah. But you see that old idea, though, in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Kind of.
Like, as soon as the electricity goes into him, well, that's the thing. That's the thing that...
But electricity is energy.
Right, right. But that's the thing that gives him life.
Energy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. right. But doesn't make you a person to have electricity run through you.
That's based on a different thing that was happening in science at the time because there was I won't even try to say his name because I'll get it wrong, but there's a French dude who noticed that if you have like frog legs and
you apply
electricity to them, they'll twitch and so you can stimulate muscles electrically, which is part of how muscle fiber works. And so they were just finding this out, and it's like, okay, wow, if we can do this with muscle fiber, maybe you could do it with a whole person if you electrified a dead body the right way.
Yeah. Well, in a certain way, it is true. Like if your heart stops and you apply the proper
– Yeah, code blue.
Yeah, I don't like to hear code blue. Lots and lots of callers already. As a matter of fact, lines are filling up as we speak. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Our topic is whatever question you might have about the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, or about religion in general, about morals, ethics. All those questions are welcome. You don't have to be Catholic to call. We'll start with Kyle in Forest Lake, Minnesota, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Kyle, you're on with Jimmy Akin.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about energy, but the weird new age kind.
Okay.
My mom, so I went to this lady once before, and she did this weird, she says it's like some ancient like type of healing where like, she would like basically swing this pendulum thing around, like over, up and down your body to figure, I don't know, it was really weird.
Okay.
And also... So she like talked, she's very Christian. She said that she's like seen angels since she was like young and like they talked to her and stuff. But I don't know. My question is really just like, and she like talks about energy a lot. And my mom is like trying to get into her Catholic faith, and I'm trying my best to get her into her Catholic faith. And like when she goes to this girl, like, I don't know, she's starts to get the wrong ideas. Like the first time I went to her, she talked a lot on the Catholic Church. She is a Christian, but like, I don't know. My question is just like, what's the Catholic Church's stance on energy? And also she gave my mom like this rock thing, and like my mom like puts it under her pillow next to her, and like it's like the size of my palm. It's like this huge rock, and I don't know how I feel about that.
Okay. Well, I guess I'd say a few things. The first one is that the Catholic Church doesn't recognize this form of, I guess, spiritual energy that this person is talking to your mom about. I don't know whether this person bills herself as a psychic or as a healer or as a exactly what she's billing herself as. But you do find this idea in New Age circles that there's some kind of mystical energy that's not subject to scientific investigation that can be manipulated by physical objects like crystals or pyramids or rocks or pendulums or even other things. And the problem is that it sort of falls between two stools, if I can put it that way. It's not supported scientifically. So that's a problem for it. And it's not supported by divine revelation. It's not something that Scripture and the Church Fathers endorse either. And so coming from a Christian point of view, if you can't validate it either by human experience in science, or which is essentially a measured, tested form of human experience, and if you can't validate it by divine revelation, then how can you have any confidence in it? I don't know what effects this woman is claiming this energy has, but I would suspect that there aren't a lot of really observable effects. And if there are any perceived effects at all, they're more likely attributable to a known phenomenon called the placebo effect, where we want something to work, and so we convince ourselves that it does. And sometimes that can even have some beneficial effects on us. Like if, you know, someone is told a sugar pill is going to reduce their anxiety, you know, maybe they have crippling anxiety and they can't take other anti-anxiety medicines for some reason, so that they're given a sugar pill and they're told this will help with your anxiety, and they take it and they calm down. Well, it's not because the sugar's doing that. If anything, sugar would ramp up your anxiety. But just the fact that the person wants it to work can have an anti-anxiety effect. You know, it gives them permission to calm down. And so, you know, this rock that your mom's sleeping with under her pillow, if it's supposed to have some kind of mystical influence, it's probably not having any influence at all. And if it does have any influence, it's or that your mom perceives, it's likely just placebo effect. So I would, in dealing with your mom, I would say, you know, you're Catholic. You're trying to get closer to your Catholic faith. That's awesome. Let's do that. Let's start reading the Catechism together, and you will encounter passages in the Catechism that talk about phenomena like this. But I wouldn't necessarily go to those passages immediately. I mean, you might, but you also might not. You might just say, "Hey, let's study our faith a little bit together." And as your mom becomes more attached to her Catholic faith, and, you know, she may have questions and concerns, and answering questions and concerns is all about what we do at Catholic Answers. So, you know, Catholic.com is a resource for you. We have a lot of online resources for free there. If your mom ever has questions, she's welcome to call into the show or use the forums or use our Q&A feature. There's all kinds of ways to help your mom grow in her Catholic faith. And over the course of time, these other kind of non-Catholic practices are likely to fall in line and kind of go away as your mom gets a stronger grasp on her Catholic faith, which is an awesome thing, and it's a sign that God's working in her life.
Kyle, we have to go to a break, but thank you very, very much for that call. Call anytime with questions. We'll be right back after this with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here with a couple of very special offers for all of you interested in standing up for the rights of the unborn. January is Pro-Life Month, and to get as many people as we can involved in the pro-life cause, we're making my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, and my DVD, Making the Case for Life, available for just $5 each. That's a saving of over 70%. I wrote this book and I made this DVD specifically with you in mind, to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue and give you the tools you need to change people's hearts and minds, so that together we might build up a pro-life culture, one person, one conversation at a time. To get your copies of my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, or my DVD, Making the Case for Life, for just $5, call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com.
It might be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never seem to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Cy Kellett, your host, Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour for Open Forum. If you have a question, 888-31-TRUTH is the number, 888-318-7884. January is Pro-Life Month, and to get as many people involved as we can in the pro-life cause, we're making Trent Horn's DVD, Making the Case for Life, available for just $5 a copy. That's a savings of more than 70%. It was made specifically with you in mind to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue and give you the tools you need to change people's hearts and minds. And, you know, together, I do think we're having some success. There's signs of building a culture of life. So we'd love to get this DVD into your hands for just $5 a copy. Go to shop.catholic.com, shop.catholic.com, and get yours for $5 right now. As I said, Jimmy Akin is our guest. And Jimmy, our next call comes from Joshua, Texas, from the Catholic Answers Live app. August is listening. August, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, sir. How are you all doing?
Very well. Thank you.
All right. My question was, this has to do with a question that came up in a confirmation class I was teaching, but is the quote-unquote last four things specifically a doctrine of the Church itself, or is it a catechetical formula harmonizing the doctrines on death, judgment, heaven, and hell?
Okay, so you just named the four last things, death, judgment, heaven, and hell. And as you or the person you're asking on behalf of is correctly intuited, that's really a catechetical formula. It's not a doctrine per se. It's a listing of four different subjects that there is Catholic teaching about. But that single formula of four last things, death, judgment, hell, and heaven, that's a way to organize and remember Catholic teachings on these areas, that these are four subjects that we need to talk about when we're talking about the last things. But it doesn't exhaust the last things. I mean, you'll notice, for example, purgatory isn't mentioned there. And purgatory is something that is one of the last things. It's something that a lot of people encounter at the particular judgment after death and before they go to heaven. So it's something that you would think kind of ought to be, why aren't there five last things? And then it also doesn't deal with a whole other class of last things, because if you look at death, judgment, hell, and heaven, and even if you add purgatory to that, we're all talking about the last things that we experience as individuals. And in theology, that's sometimes called personal eschatology. Eschatos in Greek means the last. And so the eschaton is the last times. And eschatology is the study of the last things. And so personal eschatology are the last things that will happen to us as individuals. We're going to die. We're going to experience judgment. We're going to go to hell or heaven and purgatory potentially. But there's this whole other class of last things that isn't even mentioned in that group, like the second coming and the resurrection of the dead and the new heaven and the new earth and the Antichrist and things like that. And those are what's known sometimes as corporate eschatology or general eschatology, because it's not something that every one of us is going to have happen to us. We're not individually all going to be alive at the time of the Antichrist or at the time of the second coming. And so these events are sometimes grouped differently. They're not part of personal eschatology or the personal last things, but of what's going to happen to God's people corporately or in general. And so there's this difference between personal eschatology and general eschatology, and the four last things, so-called, are really just a subset of personal eschatology, and they don't even cover all of that, much less do they cover all of the last things there are to talk about. So you or the person you're asking on behalf of is correct. It's really a catechetical formula, not a doctrine in itself. It's a way of helping us remember certain doctrines.
August, thank you very, very much for that call. I hope that that was helpful. We go now to Stephen in East Jordan, Michigan, listening on 90.9 FM. Stephen, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Mr. Akin. It's my birthday, so I get a longer, long-winded question, right?
Well, happy birthday, but let's try to keep the question as concise as we can.
I love your show. My point would be better made first before the question. I think the church, I love the Catholic Church, I'm Catholic. Why don't we take a more aggressive stance in the liturgy, like say during the prayers of the faithful, at defining that abortion is murder, instead of calling for just a respect for life in general? Many parishes do that. I can't say all of them. And then we should realize that we have to end the egregious sin of abortion by starting, instead of trying to repeal Roe versus Wade right from the beginning, because that strategy has failed. Maybe we should try to petition our bishops, to petition the legislator to come up with something that where if you marry somebody through the sacrament in the Catholic Church, if you marry a Catholic woman, that she would sign a contract and never get an abortion. Ending abortion within the church first before you try to repeal Roe versus Wade to the rest of secular society. Thanks for your time.
Okay. So anytime anyone asks a question that can be put in the form, why don't you hear more about X? The answer is always the same, because people choose not to. They choose to put their emphasis on other things. And whether they ought to emphasize one thing more than another is a judgment call. And personally, in my judgment, I think it would be good to hear more about the need to end abortion and protect life in, say, the prayers of the faithful. I think that I think it would have been good to be hearing about that more for the last 60-something years, because it was in part the churches of America, not just the Catholic Church, but the churches of America slacking off on this subject and not holding politicians accountable that led to the situation we're in now. So I would be in favor of hearing more about this in the liturgy. Having said that, given that we're in the situation we're in right now, there has to be prudence exercised regarding how much we're going to hear about it. Because if you suddenly had, you know, really frequent and really insistent and really harshly worded even discussions of this in the prayers of the faithful, there could be an alienation of people we need to win over, because not everybody is where they need to be right now. And there's a saying that sometimes used, a flock travels at the speed of the slowest sheep. And, you know, you don't want to let the slowest sheep govern the flock, but you also have to be mindful of the need to bring people along. And that can mean holding back on some stuff. As Jesus said in John's gospel, to the apostles themselves, I have many things to tell you that you cannot now bear. Mm-hmm. And so even Jesus recognized the principle, even with his own apostles, that you have to lead people along because they're not always ready for the full truth all at once. And so as part of the calculus that various church leaders have had to engage in as a result of their pastoral responsibilities, they've judged that a certain level of discussion of life issues is appropriate. But they don't want to go further than that, because they're afraid of alienating people that need to be won over. Now, different church leaders have different opinions on this, and you know that's pretty obvious. Even among very high church leaders, they have different opinions about what level of stress on these issues versus other issues is appropriate, because you've got a finite amount of time, and you can only stress a certain number of things. And so choices have to be made. Different leaders have different impressions. One thing I would say is don't confuse your experience of your local church with the way it is in the church as a whole. Because I know for a fact there are places here in the United States where you hear about abortion regularly in the prayers of the faithful. I mean, if you go into, let's say, some parts of Georgia, I know there are parishes there where this gets mentioned at every Mass. And so it really depends on where you are. I see, you know, Stephen, that you're in Michigan, which is a state of a different complexion. It has a different kind of political culture, different population. And so you would expect that to have an impact on how much can we do in bringing people along in the liturgy in this way. Also, I just have a personal thought that I personally, I don't like it when prayer is used as a way of preaching at people. Prayer is when we're talking to God. Any consideration of the people around us is secondary. And if we decide to use prayer as a way of communicating information to people, we really should move that over into the homily.
Yeah,
and keep our prayers devoted to worshiping God and asking God for things and not preaching, covertly preaching to the congregation.
Stephen, happy birthday to you. Thanks very much for that question. It is open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. 888-318-7884 is our number. We'll be right back with more after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
The best way to pray is to go to the Word of God, because it's Jesus. You're encountering the living God every time you go to His Word. And you always ask the Holy Spirit to reveal to you His Word and to speak to your heart. And then you read the Word of God until He takes a 2x4 and whacks you over the head. And then you stop, you listen, and you respond to that verse.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Just like the saints of the Counter-Reformation, our own souls are in constant need of reform, of reconversion to God and His will for us. We struggle with sin. We become distracted in prayer. We find it hard to be loving and easy to be selfish. In Reform Yourself, Sean McAfee shows you how these magnificent saints can be guides to your own personal transformation. We all need to reform our souls. Let the saints who reformed the church show you how. Order your copy of Reform Yourself today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did the Catholic Church add books to the Bible? Or did Protestants remove 7 books from the Old Testament? Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger takes you on a fact-filled tour through the history of the Bible, revealing the whole story behind the lost books of the Protestant Old Testament. With the latest information and discourse on crucial issues, Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger is a book that belongs in the library of every serious student of Scripture. And as a special bonus, if you order online, we'll add an e-book copy of 15 Myths, Mistakes, and Misrepresentations about the Deuterocanon to your order absolutely free. Get your free e-book today. Order your copy of Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger by logging on to our online shop at shop.catholic.com.
Welcome back to Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And Open Forum is open for business. 888-318-7884, the number. Happy to take your calls. Questions having to do with faith and belief and anything that might... Maybe you have a question like, I always wondered why Catholics did that. This would be a great day to call. 888-318-7884. You can be Catholic and call. You can be non-Catholic and call. Anybody's welcome to call. Shonda did in Maryland, listening on 1160 AM. Shonda, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So I have 2 questions.
Okay.
They're kind of related.
Okay. What's the first?
So the first one, in light of the fact that it was Epiphany Sunday this past Sunday, I was just wondering what the significance of the 3 gifts that the 3 wise men brought for Jesus.
Okay.
And then did you want me to ask the second one?
Yeah, why don't you go ahead so I can relate the two if need be.
Okay. All right. So the second one was about incense during Mass. Because I know that it's not used at every Mass, only on special occasions. So I was just wondering what the importance of the incense is. And why it's only used at certain masses and not others.
Sure. So in regard to the first question, the gold, frankincense, and myrrh are they're the three gifts that the wise men bring. Incidentally, we're not told that there are three wise men. In all likelihood, there could have been a lot more than that. But the reason that people tend to assume there are three is because three gifts are mentioned. And in terms of understanding their significance, we have to distinguish a couple of different levels. One level is what they literally meant in that culture at that time. Well, gold is money, and incense was something that people would have. They would burn it. It smelled nice, and it was a kind of luxury. Myrrh was something similar. Myrrh is another natural substance like incense, frankincense is, and it had a variety of uses. Sometimes people will connect it with Jesus's death because myrrh was sometimes used as an embalming spice. But trust me, they're not thinking, oh, we're going to save this until Jesus is way older and then use it then. That's not – they're not literally bringing the myrrh for later use at Jesus's death. They're literally bringing it because it's a substance that, like incense, was used as a kind of a luxury. And it had a variety of uses. You can look them up online. I mean, you go to Wikipedia, it'll have a discussion of this. But basically, these were all three very expensive items, and they're the kind of items that you would give to a king. One of the things that happens even today is when you have official diplomatic exchanges, there's frequently an exchange of gifts. So if, for example, you see this at the Vatican. If you see a head of state go over to the Vatican, he'll have a gift for the Pope, and the Pope will give him a gift back. And this is a common thing that that has happened all the way down through history as a way of expressing goodwill and fostering good relations between different heads of state. And so since the Magi back in their homeland had realized a new king of the Jews has been born, they wanted to foster good relations by going and paying him tribute. And so they brought the kind of gifts that you would bring a king. They brought gold and then the luxury items, frankincense and myrrh. And it was a way of fostering good relations with the Jewish people and with the prospective Jewish king, so that presumably once he's an adult and he takes the throne, he remembers the people that paid him tribute at his birth and has good diplomatic relations with them. That's presumably what they're thinking is happening on the literal level. Now, they didn't know that this is a very unusual king of the Jews. It's not just an ordinary king, which is why he wasn't born in Herod's palace. You know, you have they show up in Jerusalem, they go to Herod's palace. Why? Because that's where you'd expect a newborn Jewish king to be. You know, you don't expect him off somewhere else. It wasn't the star that told him to go there. The star is never depicted as leading them. It's depicted as being in front of them when they go to Bethlehem. But this business about they're following the star, it's not there in the text. They go to Jerusalem because that's where you expect the new king of the Jews to be. And so then they find out this is a very different kind of king. They have an angelic dream that tells them to go back to their own country by another route. And so there's more here than just the literal sense that they were expecting going on. On the literal sense, these are luxury items for a king. But because they're also taken up into God's plan, if you want to see a second spiritual level here where maybe you do relate the myrrh symbolically to Jesus's death, you can do that. But we just need to make sure we keep that on the spiritual level of interpretation of the text, not the literal level. In terms of the second question about incense, symbolizes a variety of things. One thing that is just obvious is it smells good. And that's why one reason people have used it is a way of giving honor to God by generating a good smell. Also, the smoke from incense visibly goes up and ascends to the heavens, to the sky, which is where we depict God as being. He's really outside of space and time, but we depict him in the sky. And so since the smoke ascends to the sky, it's kind of like our prayers going up to God. And so in Scripture, we find the symbol of incense, and you'll see this in the book of Revelation in a couple of places. We see the symbol of incense used to symbolize prayers ascending before God. And so that's another symbol that it has. Symbolic value it has. In terms of why it's used in some masses rather than others, it's because it's different. It's because it's special. And so by reserving its use for certain masses, it helps add a greater solemnity to those masses. If it was used at every single mass, it would be ordinary, and we'd be deprived of one way of making certain masses even more special. There's also, frankly, another reason, although this one is new. This is not something that's really been around for a long time. There are a lot of people today who have allergy problems, possibly caused by the fact that as children, our immune systems are not exposed to enough germs these days. We're too clean, and that leads to a hyperactive immune system that produces allergies. And so you have a lot more awareness today of people with chemical sensitivities who can be allergic to the incense. And so that's actually, speaking frankly, a practical reason that it's not used in some masses, because there are parish staffs out there who are concerned about people who might have chemical sensitivities and be allergic to it.
Okay, Chandra?
Yes, that was perfect. Thank you so much.
All right, very good. Great talking with you. Thank you. The incense used to drive me crazy when I was an altar boy when I was little.
Uh-huh.
Now I love it. Mm-hmm. I guess it's like broccoli too. I didn't like broccoli when I was. Maybe it's an acquired taste.
It could also be that you don't have it directly in your face the way you might have as an altar boy.
That's the thing, is it would just go straight up
your nose.
It can
be really overpowering.
Yeah. Yeah. 888-318-7884 is the number. I want to share with you a question from Facebook.
Yeah.
Pepper on Facebook was reading Matthew chapter 7, mm-hmm, and got to verse 6. And wondered about the meaning of I'll just read it to you real quickly in one version.
Okay.
Do not give to dogs what is holy, and do not throw your pearls before swine, lest they trample them underfoot and turn to attack you.
Yeah. So Jesus is articulating a general principle here. Some people do not have a proper appreciation of what's holy. Some people, and in this metaphor, he's comparing those people to dogs or pigs, because dogs and pigs have no appreciation for the value of a pearl. Okay, if you have dogs and pigs, and if someone's a human like you are, Cy.
Yes, thank you for acknowledging that.
That is correct, right?
Well, unless there's a full moon out.
Okay, so you're a human being, yeah. and if I want to curry favor with you, I could bring you a pearl.
Here's
some
me.
Pearls. Aren't these great? I want you to have them. And that would foster good relations with us.
We should act this out. Next time, bring pearls.
Okay.
We'll do it.
I'll cut up one of those dime store necklaces then. but if I try to do that with a dog or a pig that's hostile towards me, dog or the pig is not going to care.
Right.
And will just still attack me anyway.
Yeah.
And so Jesus is using that reality as a way of teaching us a lesson about human interactions, because even some human beings are in the position with respect to the holy of not appreciating its value. And so those people, if they're hostile to us, then sharing what's holy with them is not going to benefit us. They'll profane whatever the holy thing is that we're sharing with them and then proceed to attack us anyway.
Yeah.
And this has had a variety of applications over the course of the years, over the centuries. Sometimes it's been applied to the sacraments.
Yeah.
You know, don't give the Eucharist to someone who doesn't
baptized.
Appreciate it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And by doing the things you need to do, like being baptized to receive it. It's also applicable in other situations. Like if someone, let's say I'm on one of those horrible TV angry debate shows that you see on news channels,
yeah,
and I'm up against some rabidly anti-Christian person.
Right.
That's not the time for me to start talking about the most sensitive, precious things about my faith right there, because they're likely to turn around and just start blaspheming those very things,
right,
and continue to attack me and profaning the precious pearls of wisdom I may otherwise be sharing. So it's what Jesus is counseling here is prudence, recognizing the situation you're in and the kind of person you're dealing with and how they're going to react, and don't automatically assume that they're going to have a full appreciation for the holy that will lead to a positive response. Sometimes you need to protect what's holy by not exposing it to their profanation.
Pepper, I hope that that was helpful for you. Did you grow up around pigs at all?
Cows,
yeah.
And dogs, but
I didn't
not
know
pigs.
That pigs do attack you. Pigs attack people.
They can.
I learned that late in life, not by being attacked by a pig.
Well, in
I
fact,
just didn't grow up
wild
pigs.
Boars are particularly known for attacking people.
Yeah.
And they can even – big ones can be dangerous.
Yeah. Well, all right. So, Pepper, thanks for that question. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Hello, everyone. This is country music artist Colin Ray. Do what I do and keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
January is Pro-Life Month, and to get as many people as we can involved in the pro-life cause, we're making Trent Horn's book, Persuasive Pro-Life, available for just $5 a copy. That's a savings of over 70%. This book was made specifically with you in mind to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue and to give you the tools you need to change people's hearts and minds so that together we might build up a pro-life culture one person, one conversation at a time. To get your copies of the book Persuasive Pro-Life for just $5 each, call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
As the legend goes, the Protestant Reformation began when Martin Luther nailed a list of his grievances with the Catholic Church to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg, Germany. But do you know the whole story? In Catholic Answers' brand new documentary, The Protestant Revolution, you will hear from top apologists Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin, Carla Broussard, Trent Horn, and Steve Weidenkopf as they expose the errors of Martin Luther and of the other so-called reformers. This DVD will give you a clearer understanding of our Protestant brothers and sisters, and you will be better equipped to engage them about what separates us and about what unites us. Order your copy of The Protestant Revolution today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting shop.catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. That's not the groovy music yet, is it there, Nick? That is not the groovy music yet, but all right, it's music. It'll do. But we were just talking at the break about Facebook. We noticed that Facebook changed some of their policies. I guess YouTube did too, that you have to accept notifications.
Yeah, tell it to send you notifications when we're on if you want the reminder.
Right. So if you haven't been getting your notifications, you might want to do that.
I know the way you do that on YouTube is there's like a bell icon and you click on the bell icon
and it'll send you
notifications.
Yeah, because we don't want you to miss out on Catholic Answers. But no. I think that's just
that Catholic answery goodness.
I know, delicious Catholic buttery Catholic answery goodness.
Yeah.
I don't think that was directed at us though. Do you think that Facebook is attacking us and being mean to us?
Well, you know what they say.
What do they say, Jimmy?
Big corporate entities like Google or in its parent company Alphabet and Facebook don't always have Christian values at heart.
You know, there's been some I don't know that much about it, but there's been some evidence coming out about about prejudicing these things against Christian outlets. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that that's what this is about. I'm just saying
but you can defeat it by clicking the notifications.
Just say you want to get notifications on Facebook because we love having you there on Facebook. And thanks to everybody who joins us on Facebook, Periscope, YouTube. And anywhere else that we might be streaming. It is open forum this hour. We still got Jimmy Akin for a while, so let's try to get as many questions as we can in before he goes. Next hour, Trent Horn will be here. So if we don't get to you this hour, don't go anywhere. Don't despair. Trent will be here to take your questions. But let's go now to Shanika in Houston, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Shanika, your question for Jimmy Akin. Oh, Shanika, I think we have a connection problem there.
It's important once you get on the line and you get through the call screening to keep your ear to the phone, because there's a time lag, as we've discussed, between when we pick it up and when you're going to hear it on the radio.
Well, so she dropped. I think that
don't
that,
rely
that,
on your radio.
She might have been driving or something and hit a dead spot outside of Houston at a bend in the road.
They got those,
you know, the spot
big,
I'm talking about.
Big loops around the city.
I know that. Yeah, right.
Yeah, the two big ones.
Okay, let's try Joanna in Cummington, Massachusetts, listening on Catholic.com. Joanna, thanks for calling. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello. I want to say a prayer to Fulton Sheen.
Okay.
How would I address him? And Fulton Sheen, pray for us.
Venerable.
He's not a blessed yet, so I can't say that.
Venerable.
Furthermore, what are the levels of addresses, from a normal person all the way up to a saint?
Okay. So you would address Fulton Sheen as venerable, and the levels are servant of God, then venerable, then blessed or beatus, and then saint.
Does that make sense to you,
Joanna? All right, thank
Joanna?
You.
What about if you're addressing a family member, though? Like, say my grandmother died years and years ago. Say I wanted to – I can just say grandma, right?
Yeah.
Like, you just call her.
Whatever you would have called her in life.
Yep.
But unless she's had a cause open, she's not yet, you know, Saint Grandma or anything like that.
Saint Grandma. She would like that, actually. Okay, yeah. I know what I can talk to my grandfather, too, but he always said I could call him anything just so long as –
Didn't call him late for dinner?
Exactly.
That was a saying in his generation, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Right. Pablo in Atlanta, Georgia, listening on the EWTN app. Pablo, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Thank you, Jimmy and Cy. My question is the following. Jimmy, if you could please expand a little bit on the – I want to understand the interaction between the soul and the body.
Mm-hmm.
I hear people saying – you know, I'm a soul trapped in this body and so on. So like they're two different separate entities. So I just wanted to, if you could please explain, you know, what the interaction is right now and then when we die and so on.
Okay. I can, now this, there's a lot that can be said here, and there are a lot of actually open questions regarding this that are dealt with in various disciplines. In theological anthropology is one of them. In philosophy, the problem of mind is one of them. The mind-body problem is one of them. But in basic terms, from a Christian point of view, the soul and the body are intimately related, so that in fact, it's an infallibly defined teaching of the Catholic Church that the soul is the substantial form of the human body. Now, as soon as I say that, I got to give a caution, because form does not mean shape. When we hear about the form of something, we associate it with shape. And that's the way the word form is used in English, but it's not the way it's used in philosophical theology, which is the relevant usage here. But nevertheless, without going into a big lecture on what it all means philosophically, it indicates that there's a very intimate connection between the soul and the body, such that without the soul, you don't even have a living body. You don't have a human body. It requires the soul to have a human being. Also, because that's our natural state, to be embodied spirits as humans, which is different than angels. They're just spirits. They don't naturally have a body, but we do. So you also don't have a complete human being if you just have a spirit. Our spirit does survive death, so it is capable of existing without the body, but it's not a complete human being. You really need both parts, because since our souls are the substantial form of a body, it needs that body there to be complete. And so there's a very intimate relationship. It's not accurate to say we're a soul trapped in a body. It can sometimes feel that way. You know, if someone is, let's say, sick and suffering, they can feel trapped in a body. And so it's not wrong necessarily to use that kind of language poetically. St. Paul even comes close to using that when he says, I'd rather depart from the body and be with Christ. He doesn't say I'm trapped, but he says I'd rather be away from the body and be with Christ, just because of how great it is to be with Christ. You also find language in Scripture where Paul kind of compares the human body to a tent, where he'll talk about dwelling in our present tabernacle, our present earthly tent of our body. But then we're going to get a big upgrade in the next life, at the resurrection of the dead. So you do have this language in Scripture where sometimes images are used of a soul as if it's dwelling within or within a structure that's compared to our body. But those analogies, like all analogies, have their limits. And in reality, there's a much tighter and more intimate connection between the soul and the body than what those images suggest. So they express partial truths, but not the full truth.
How's that strike you, Pablo?
That sounds fascinating. I appreciate very much, Jimmy. And I'm just going to keep looking in Catholic.com. To expand a little bit more.
Awesome. Yeah. Sounds great.
It's awesome.
Yeah, because it is one of those things that you can just keep exploring.
There are whole books
you're not
written
going to exhaust
on this subject.
It.
Yeah.
Right, right. Let's go to Zach in Rochester, New York, listening on 92.9 FM. Zach, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Very well, Zach.
So my question is, when a police officer or a member of the military has to unfortunately take someone else's life in order to protect others. Mm-hmm. Is that a sin that could be forgiven?
It's not a sin at all. If he has to take someone's life in order to protect others, if someone is a bad actor, whether they're a criminal or a terrorist or an enemy soldier, and there's no other better, more effective way for him to protect innocence than to take that person's life, then taking that person's life is not a sin and doesn't need to be forgiven. In fact, it can be a meritorious act if you're protecting innocent life. It's regrettable, it's sad, and it's going to be traumatic because almost everybody who – we're not natively designed to take human life, and there have been various studies like of military soldiers who have experienced combat, and almost everybody who actually does take a life – and one of the things they found is a lot of soldiers will just shoot high just because they can't. And it's actually a startlingly high number of people on their first encounter, even though they've been trained for combat, can't bring themselves to actually target another human being and will shoot high and deliberately miss. Mm-hmm. But of those who actually end up taking life, a huge – it's like more than 90% of them will report later being very traumatized by that. Only a small number don't. And those people tend to have psychopathic tendencies, which is a lack of empathy. And so almost everybody who ends up taking a life is really traumatized by it. Now, it can be necessary – and it can be meritorious, but it is very regrettable. It is something we want to try to avoid. And if we have to do it, we're likely to experience traumatic consequences unless there's something broken about us to where we don't have empathy. Because if you have empathy, the fact that you've taken another life is really going to eat on you. So that's a general sketch of the ethics of that situation and of the psychological reality of the situation as well.
Does that address what you were getting at, Zach?
Yeah. I have a quick follow-up question, though.
Okay.
If both guys think they're protecting innocence, then is it still a forgivable – well, I mean, you said it wasn't a sin, but
that's right.
Still something that could be acceptable if both sides are – thinking they're protecting innocence?
So there's a famous quote from Abraham Lincoln that whenever you have two sides in a war, at most one of them can have a just cause. You can't justly have two people fighting each other. Somebody is in the wrong. Maybe both people are in the wrong. The way the question is phrased of if someone has to do it to protect the innocent, well, then it wouldn't be a sin. But if you have both sides fighting each other in good faith, to where a soldier on both sides, they think they're doing the right thing, well, objectively, at least one of them has to be wrong, because God never commands us to righteously fight each other. He's a God of peace, not of war. And, because they're both in good conscience, So let's say it's World War One. You got a British soldier and a German soldier. They're both fighting for their country. They both think they're doing the right thing. Because they think they're doing the right thing through no fault of their own, God won't hold them accountable. It is objectively still a sin for whichever one of them is wrong.
But they don't have the power
because don't know that it's a sin.
Right.
God's not going to hold them accountable for it. And so God will treat them as if they had not sinned, although they'll find out what the truth was after the fact in the next life.
Zach, thank you very much for that. Jimmy Akin, Luigi Galvani.
Galvani, yeah.
Oh,
the frog guy.
Yeah, he's the guy that could make the frog
legs. I never
legs
made
dance.
The frog legs jump. I would eat them as a kid.
Eat frog legs?
We'd go frog gigging and catch frogs and eat their legs.
I've still, to this day, I've never eaten a frog leg, but I've heard they taste like chicken. But that's what people say about everything.
Yeah, it tastes fishier than chicken.
Trent Horn's coming up next hour. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't called, 888-318-7884 is the number. Open forum continues with Trent after this on Catholic Answers Live. Thanks.